The whole history of art is essentially 90% the history of a gifted person servanting some other endeavor. Art was always intended, at its best, to servant the kingdom, or servant the church, or servant industry, whatever, a whole lot of things, some of which probably didn't need serving. But most, a vast majority of it, was intended for other function, other aspects of society. Not just simply to hang there all by itself so that people could come and pay homage to it in isolation as an art form. And what that, of course, does is not only isolates the art from the rest of society, but isolates the artist from society as well. And now artists are no longer able to of the possibility of their role as servant. Vincent sold one painting in his lifetime. I guess you could call it selling. He actually gave it to somebody in exchange for ham and cheese and a glass of beer. And that painting last year sold for $43 million. $43 billion. What did you do for $43 billion? There, it isn't worth it. It is not worth it. There is no work of art in the world worth $43 million. It's just unbelievable that we start. I mean, what if Vincent had had $43 million, he wouldn't have paid it. You would not have. It is the antithesis of art. It is the opposite. To take art out of its serpentine role is not just to destroy the art, it's to destroy the artist. Sometimes I speak like a fool because I assume certain things, and that's very dangerous. I never assume too much. Look. A Luther church in Manhattan, some of you may have heard of it. It is built on the ground floor of the City Court building. St. Peter's Lutheran Church had a big facility in downtown Manhattan, and the City Court people wanted to build, and so they made a deal with St. Peter's Lutheran Church to buy that church and the property in which it sat. Build this humongous skyscraper and put this church on the ground floor of it. The narthex of this church is a mall. That's a great idea. I think that's really neat. Boy, talk about customers. That's great. I mean, you know, you just walk in. That's kind of tedious. You walk into the Walden bookstore, you know, the card shop, the Hallmark. Oh my gosh, I'm in a church. this kind of vacant mindset, these glassy stares that people have when they're walking through the mall, you know, like where's the next sale? And I mean, St. Peter's is going to get some customers that way. You know, never even realized what they were. St. Peter's should have special end of the month sales. Free old bullets. Well, St. Peter's Foundation read an article in the paper that was interviewing an artist by the name of Willem de Kooning. Has anybody heard of de Kooning? A Dutch guy? I think he hated his mother because he did these paintings you know, abstract expressionists, really, a lot of paint and fleshy colors. And some, for some reason, in the New York Times, the guy who had interviewed de Kooning asked him why he had never done a church, why he had never done art for a church. And you know, it's an interesting question because de Kooning, that's Dutch, all right? And if you look at some other Dutch guys of even more renown, like Vincent van Gogh and Rembrandt, they never did any work for churches either. Those guys never did any work for churches. So it's a reasonable question. And so they asked William de Kooning, why he had never done any work for a church? And de Kooning answered, because nobody asked him. Of course, the interviewer then continued that line of questioning and say, you know, have you ever wondered why nobody ever asked you for any for a church? Because let it go with that. And this guy from St. Peter's Lutheran Church said, whoa, would that be a feather in our cap if we asked him to do a painting for us? For over the altar, an altar piece. For over the altar. And so on his own, he went to Wilhelm de Kooning, who said, okay, I'll interview you, but my agent will have to be here. Oh, gosh. It's so sad. Art, a lot of art is really sad. And they went to Wilhelm de Kooning and they said, why not do a crucifixion go over our altar? Would you like that? He said, yeah, I'd really like that. Talk to my agent, work it out. So he did. $1 million. $1 million for this painting that Wilhelm de Kooning would do for the church. And the guy, who wasn't representing anybody but himself, said, boy, does that sound great. Does that ever sound great? We'll be on the map with an original Wilhelm de Kooning over our altar. So de Kooning started painting. And the church still hadn't even heard about it. When they finally got word that they were, you know, likely to be in hot for $1 million, and that they were going to have to go around and find some sugar daddy to pop for this project, they started getting really serious about, is it appropriate to ask Wilhelm de Kooning to do something like that for us? Is it appropriate for, would his style be compatible to our architecture? And that's what they asked me to come to New York to talk to them about. Would Wilhelm de Kooning's style be appropriate to our architecture as it hung over the altar? Well, now by the time I got there, the congregation was split in two. Pro-Wilhelm and anti-Wilhelm. So I am, you know, between a rock and a hard place as I talk to the congregation. I started out by saying, you know, I am here to talk to you about whether de Kooning's style was compatible to your architecture. And other people are going to talk to you about Wilhelm de Kooning, the artist. And other people are going to talk to you about your architecture. And a whole set of discussions that was supposed to give them information. I said, I noticed in your list of discussions that nobody is going to talk to you about whether spending $1 million on paint and canvas is compatible with your ministry in the world. While you got street people going up and down your sidewalk, peeking in through there, they lean up against your building, while you've got Ethiopians dying like flies, you're going to spend $1 million on a painting. And I said, I find it so unconscionable. I find it so absurd that a church would even consider it. that I will just simply stand here and field questions, but I refuse to talk about any aesthetic justification for doing that. Because there isn't any other justification for doing it. So why go to the trouble of trying to justify it aesthetically? Well, we started, the questions came like crazy. The first one was, what about the widow's money? What about the widow's money? I said, sure. If a widow can afford $1 million and it's her last million to give you a zakunin, sure, go ahead. Well, what about Mary Magdalene pouring ointment on Jesus' feet? I said, Mary Magdalene could not cop for $1 million to pour oil paint on Jesus' feet. She couldn't afford it. She could just do the best she could. This is not the best you could. Not by a long shot. They said, well, look at the Gothic cathedrals. With all the wonderful stained glass, all the art, is that too extravagant? I said, have you ever been to a Gothic cathedral and worshiped there? I don't mean as a tourist, but actually sat and worshiped. Oh, yeah. We had. I said, then tell me what is over the altar of Chartres Cathedral. Stained glass window? No, it's not. The nearest stained glass windows to the altar at Chartres Cathedral is about 150 feet, 200 feet away. What is right over the altar, where you want to put your dekuning? What is over the altar? A crucifix? We can go down this list of possibilities. I mean, they could still be there trying to figure it out, because they never get the right answer. A light bulb is over the altar at Chartres Cathedral. A bare light bulb on a long cord that comes way up to the ceiling. It's the weirdest looking thing you ever saw in your life. But Chartres Cathedral's congregation cannot afford, at this present time, enough candles so that the people can read from candlelight. And so they installed a long cord and they got a bare light bulb over the altar. It's beautiful. What a sign. With all that stained glass in there, and now we got a bare light bulb. Oh, it's wonderful. Well, we have just simply taken to honoring the artist by separating him or her from our midst, isolating them, and then assigning values to their work which have nothing to do with their significance as servicing our particular needs, only to their marketability. Art is marketable. It's a little scary for me to realize that I am worth more dead than alive, and it's not because of my insurance. I don't have any. It's because of my paintings, which will just skyrocket. Get them now. When I'm gone, you'll never be able to afford one. Is that stupid or what? So you buy art. I mean, there was a time when I was growing up and I was so excited to sell a painting to the Chase Manhattan Bank and realized 10 years later that they had never shown it to anybody. It was in the vault. And the vault is just full of all kinds of artwork. And when the market goes up, they sell and make a lot of money. When it goes down, they trade. baseball cards. Yeah. That's so sad. So sad. So when we go to the museum, we are not looking at art anymore anyway. The art has already taken place. Art is what you do while you're doing it. What you got after you're done is art object. Art object. It's not the same as art. Art is always something in process. Always something in a state of flux. The only way we can understand that ceiling as art is if you and it have some relationship together that changes it in your eyes or allows it to change you in your eyes. That's the only way. Otherwise, as it sits there, it is not art. It is art residue. It is the evidence that art took place there in 1975. And that's an important distinction for you to make. It's just very important. The Elend and the Dick Dick were not intended for that little cage. But it's important for us to have that residue because it may be the only way we know that such things ever existed. Okay. So what is it about? Or what was it about? Well, there was a time when we came here the first time. It was in 1972. And we came for 3 weeks in Indiana. And in 73, we came for 4 weeks. And in 74, we came for 5 weeks. And in 75, we came for the whole year. We decided we would just come and not go. And we took a sabbatical. Now Holden does that. You gotta be real careful about the Holden experience. It kind of sucks you in. It's a real trap. And it's a wonderful trap. If you gotta be trapped, this is as good a place as any. So we took our sabbatical, brought the family, the wife, and the 4 kids. The kids were all school age. The oldest was in high school. Well, the two oldest. Kathy was a freshman. Kathy was not going to come. We had to drag Kathy kicking and screaming from Old Village. We finally had to make a deal with Kathy. Eighth grade. Thank God for mothers when your daughter is in the eighth grade. Oh, Father, Lord, I felt so unnecessary. Yeah, just right off the father. The girl is in the eighth grade. And she was then going to the high school with all the chums from the eighth grade, and now we were going to drag her into the walls. Oh, boy. So we made a deal with one of our friends, in fact, Kathy's godparents back in Indiana, that after Christmas, she would be coming back to Valparaiso and spend the second half of that year with her chums back at the Valparaiso High School. She never did. She never went. You couldn't have gotten her out of here kicking and screaming. She fell in love with it. And David was in high school. So the 2 kids went to high school here. And Michael and Matthew, they went to the grade school here. And they were on the staff, all 4 of them were on the staff. And all 4 of them invented their own curriculum while they were here. This may sound very strange, But I am convinced that Holden Village does not prepare you to live anywhere else. In fact, it makes it almost impossible to live anywhere else. It ruins you. It sure ruined my kids, who had to go back to a straight educational system, and for the first year after they left here, were the most rebellious, snotty children you could possibly imagine. Because they invented here their own curriculum. You could not believe the gifts of people, like working in the kitchen. People that had gotten their master's degrees in drama or music. And all of those gifts were laid out for the kids, saying, well, here's so-and-so, she's a musician. So Kathy says, all right, I'm going to take music. And I'm going to take music from her, not from the high school teacher. There's only one teacher. Can't expect one person to know everything. So they designed the curriculum. They took poetry from a literature person who was driving a Caterpillar tractor. Sunday nights in mid-winter, we would go down and we would have our evening vespers down in Koinonia. And afterwards, we would come up the path to the kitchen, to the dining room, between snow lanterns. Lanterns carved out of the snow all over this village. And we come up the path, and we go in the dining hall, and one Sunday night, we would have a musicale with our dessert. And all the high school kids would perform. Ah, ridiculous. Who was it civilized? Oh, I mean, Henry VIII did not have such a lush environment. Such elegance. I mean, it was incredibly beautiful. Once, the kids all recited, memorized poetry. Now, you don't know my son, Michael. It was an act of God that allowed him to go through this learning process and made him love poetry. Actually, the one who taught poetry that, she is really nice looking. She's beautiful. I think that's what encouraged Michael to learn poetry. She's really swank. But there is son Michael, who was a jock. I mean, who? Huh? He was born smelling of sweat socks. And here he was up there reciting E.E. Cummings. Lord, I thank you for most this amazing day. And I just wept. I could not believe it. And they would be out on the lawn, late fall, practicing medieval dances. And then in the winter they would come and learn the music. We had dress-up times here, where everybody came to an evening meal as though it were a medieval banquet. We celebrated Frodo and Bilbo's birthday like you would not believe. Oh, I was Strider. Oh, I hate those stories. Which made me a real outcast in the village, because everybody was really gung-ho into them. I don't read fantasy kinds of things. I'm living. I mean, I read it and I say, what's the big deal? And because I see those kind of people all around me. You know, I mean, the little folks with furry feet. That's what's the big deal about that? And I go around talking to trees. So what's the deal about these things? It's nothing so special. But when they started talking about dressing up, and we would have Gollum. Oh, man, you wouldn't believe Gollum. It was a sheep. She put green jello all over her face and then waited for it to congeal and then started pulling up. I mean, she couldn't even eat the banquet feast that evening. And of course, we had six banquet feasts, right? I don't know how many of you were into this whole thing. We had six meals that day, and then there was supposed to be fireworks in the evening for a little girl's birthday. So I got on all my slides. And we had eight slide projectors, and we just flashed them all over the ceiling. And everybody sang songs. I mean, it was the most, this was like Brigadoon. This place would open up once every 100 years, you know. But we were in here for good and all, celebrating each other and just having one way of a good time. Learning things we never knew possible. And we found out that Holden has this cycle that is not like the normal cycle. It's like Bali. I fell in love with Bali this spring, and I gotta go back. Bali, people love celebrations. 25% of everybody's annual income is spent on celebrations, religious celebrations. What? They're always having them. And so anniversaries are a real big thing in Bali. And you know what those silly people went and did? They shortened the calendar. So their year is only 274 days long. Which means these things go a lot faster. It's like driving kilometers instead of miles. We just rip down the road. Boy, we're really knocking those things off. Such funny, but that's kind of the way it is here. They just redesigned the whole thing. The whole cycle of the year is different at home than in other places. And that's what the ceiling is trying to express, the uniqueness of the whole of the cycle. We have been here we have been here a year. And we went through the winter. And then finally the spring came. This place was closed down for basketball and volleyball during the winter. That's all it was used for. It's really weird watching people play volleyball and basketball in here with eight layers of clothes on. Just run up and down and blowing smoke all over the place. But it was brutal. Every time you landed, it was not like brutal. Hitting the floor. Oh, it hurt so bad. But then it all got cleaned up, and we moved in for the spring. In June of 76. And the first service in which we were here. Everybody kind of sat here. And Carol Higley, who some of you may have heard of, was the director at the time, and Carol stormed out of here. Carol was Scandinavian. A lot of storm. And was really upset. And whenever Carol got upset, you kind of hovered around and sort of said, what's the matter? What's the matter? He was outraged. I said, what's the problem? He says, such a beautiful, beautiful service in such an ugly building. And he was upset. Ugly building? Well, what do you want? What can I do to make you happy? And he said, fix it. And then he went up to her chalet and sulked. So I got out my piece of paper and my yardstick, and I came in here and I measured it all up. And then I went to my chalet and sulked. And tried to figure out what you could do in order to fix it. And the thing that came to mind primarily was the ceiling, because everything else was pretty unfixable. I mean, it's nice. But that ceiling is like Celotex beaver board, really dirty, brown, like blotter stuff. And so I said that I figured that was about the only thing that we could do to shake it up. Well, I cannot work without music. I just absolutely can't. I have to have music. And so I started trying to induce a kind of theme or motif by playing different music. So I played some Bach suites, and nothing came. I played Goldberg variations. Nothing seemed to click. I even played the Taco Bell can, and it was too short for such a big ceiling. And I played Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. And I played Judy Collins, and I played bluegrass, and I played everything I could get my hands on until finally I played Vivaldi. And that did it. Vivaldi's, the seasons just seemed to be the natural thing to induce an image. And that's what this is, the seasons. And not according to Vivaldi, but according to Holden. And I did a little sketch of about 11 by 14 of what I would do with the ceiling. And I took it up to Carol, and he said, do it. Do it. And so I went to Dick Peter Anders, who was also in the village that winter, and I said, we're going to need a scaffold, and we're going to need some paint. And on the scaffold, I'm going to have a tape recorder with a long wire so that I can play music for myself while I'm painting. And he built a scaffold that would, the top of which would raise and lower so that when I was in the center, I could lift it, and when I went to the side, I could take things down so that we, and then he put rug squares under the bottom of it. It was about 8 foot by 8 foot, I think about 24 feet tall. And it was actually very heavy. It was almost too heavy for me to move myself. But that Sunday night, he started building the scaffold, and I started making a list of supplies. Monday morning, Werner Jansen went out with my list of supplies to Wenatchee, and got gallons and gallons of latex house paint, which he then brought back Monday night. And Monday the scaffold was finished, and Tuesday I was up. And we started in the center, and gradually moved in a kind of round and round sort of direction. And when we got out to the outside, then we would start coming back in again, just back and forth, never finishing anything as we went, but always doing a little bit so that after the first couple of moves in and out, the thing was laid out. And then it was roughed in. And I had people coming in at regular intervals to move me while I stood up there. And they just pushed the scaffold around. One of the problems that we found right on, it was after about a day of painting, I just stayed up there. And guys were lifting things up. Up and down in buckets for me. I came down after, I don't know how many hours of working, and I looked up and I couldn't see anything. There was nothing there. It just soaked right up through the subtext. It was like paint with watercolor on water. So there are, in some places, about, there are like like 20 to 24 layers of color on there. I am sure that if we took the ceiling off of the, I mean the roof off of the building, there'd be a whole other mural facing up. All the stuff is right up through the cell tests. So it's really very heavy up there. And we had to have music, and I'm a night person. I worked through, there was a time in which I worked, I would work like four straight days. Just keep going day and night, through the night. And what we would do is publish a concert schedule. And we posted it on the door outside here so that people would know that at 2 o'clock we would be listening to the B minor Mass. And at 4 o'clock we would be listening to such and such. And they would come out in their little slippers. Like the little poofy things on the toes. And they would bring their blankets, and they'd lie down on these on the pews and just listen to music and watch the painting book. And so it was a very encouraging thing. The whole village participated in the making of it, and I just happened to be the one who was doing the painting. But we lived according to each other's expectations of one another. We started, of course, at the center, and a whole lot has been made out of this great circle in the center. Everything means something up there. So you know, you should know, if you ever have to explain things to people, what these various things mean. And that center, that is that's a ventilator bolt. Oh, and it's just fraught with all kinds of implications. And that's all it is. I mean, it was a given. I didn't have any choice. I painted it gold, but that's it. That's what that sucker is. It's the ventilator hole. Everything else is a little more esoteric, but that's where we started. And the whole design is kind of, you know, that kind of composition. It's divided into four equal sections, and that is summer, and that's fall, and that's winter, and that's spring. And things lead, of course, from one into the other. Now, at Holden in the summer, we celebrated Christmas on the 25th of July. Okay, crazy, but it worked. And so you have in summer, coming out of the ventilator is a great Bethlehem star. I don't know if you can make it out here. It's a four-pointy yellow star that's going down that way. And it's got a little blue star wrapped around its tail down there. The blue star with the yellow blob in the middle marks a momentous day where, as I was painting this, I stepped off the edge of the scaffold and came down and landed on my heels and found out 10 years later that I had compacted some vertebrae and needed some surgery. But I was holding the tape recorder. It was like 4:30 in the morning. And I was holding the tape recorder, and it was the Dvorak Symphony from the New World. And it was da 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 da. And when I hit the floor, all of the parts of the tape recorder went sprung, and a big blob of yellow wound up all over the floor. And two people woke up. I mean, it's high time. They should have been awake because we're talking New World Symphony here. I hadn't played it loud enough, I guess, or something. And they said, "Well, is there anything we can do to help? Are you all right?" And I said, "Well, gather the parts from this recorder, because recordings and albums and all kinds of stuff. And we put them in a box and took them over to Dick Liederhander's again, who put them all back together and made the recorder work. And I cleaned up the yellow spot on the floor, went up and talked to my wife about what happens when you fall 20 feet and land on your heels, and should I worry about it? And she says, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. She's a physical therapist, you know, who doesn't like to bring her work home from the office. I thought I was marrying a back rubber, but I didn't get that. So that afternoon, I went back up on the ceiling, and I didn't paint. I sat up there and I wrote a poem. I wrote a poem about the crucifixion and being up there on a gibbet and falling from grace. And a very long poem. And then I began painting again. So we got stars and kind of ice cream parlor colors in the summer. The fall is incredible. As those of you who've been here for a while and can sense the changes, fall is really amazing, color-wise, here. March, what is that evergreen that is deciduous?
Large.
Large, that's the other word.
Tamarack
sounds so much nicer. March. sounds like the tall guy on the Munsters. Tamarack. Ooh, that's it. Well, these are tamarack. These are not large. And what you get are these ribbons. Everything in the fall, as you look out there, starts getting ribbony. In the summer, it's like that and jagged. In the fall, you get these clouds doing this sort of thing. And then you go for the white frosting on the tops of the peaks, all lines up like that. And then these larch, and they're ribbons of yellow across the green. Do that. The color is extraordinary, and things that I would never have paid attention to normally here, all of a sudden, just, I mean, like mountain ash and Oregon grape, you never saw. I mean, these things were not little dots. They were like, ooh, they like shimmer. They were like iridescent colors. So I put Oregon grape, little balls of Oregon grape stuck up there on top of the green. And we would watch Orion over there. Orion jumped. It literally from the top of buckskin over to the top of copper. It just took a great leap. And you just follow the belt of Orion and the sword. And so there's Orion up there with the three stars in the belt jumping from buckskin to copper. Other strange things in the fall. Connecting the fall and the winter is a great butterfly. And everybody knows butterflies belong in spring and summer, except that and for me and for my family and for our particular life here, the fall to the winter change was when it really became a village. I mean, I know what your definition of village is, but when you've got 400 people here in the summer and plus another 200 staff people, and you've got two settings, or even three settings sometimes, give me a break. That ain't no village. I mean, given the amount of space you have to work in, it's as compact as Manhattan. The number of people per square foot, you might as well be downtown. When it really became a village was in the winter. When things like certain people hurting and then the whole place hurting, when that happened, it was in the winter. When a person got good news and immediately everybody knew it, that was in the winter. And so I had the whole birthing of that happening over here. And then the winter with like seedlings. There are all these seedlings in the basement of the hotel under grow lamps. And it was like we were all that. All of us were under these like 5, 6, 7 feet of snow. We were like seedlings incubating. I think more people, when they see the mirror, comment about the hot egg than any other elements of the ceiling. And that's us. We're incubating. The egg is cracked. it's steaming. And it is on fire. We were all cozy in here, doing wonderful, wonderful things. There was life going on under this white blanket that covered everything. And it was very, very exciting. I just really loved it here in the winter. Being from St. Louis and having taught at Valpo for 22 years in Indiana, I'm a poor winter. Oh, winter is just terrible. I mean, you get 4 inches of snow and everything would close down. You wind up with 18 feet in front of your carport because of this blooming wind. Everybody talked about wind chill factor. There's no wind chill factor here. No wind chill factor. Somebody get 20 inches of snow someday, everybody's out there in their squares, dancing around like idiots. Just amazing, wonderful stuff. And then comes the mud luscious spring, you know. When, like I was saying last night, you found 11 minutes of sun. The sun finally showed up in the saddle between Buckskin and Copper for 11 minutes the first day, and all the guys went out and stood in the middle of the snow and took their tops off. You know, just, oh, burn. You know, trying to get that little, the first rays of that new sun that was going to come. And things started popping up through the snow, glacier lilies, avalanche lilies, the most amazing things you ever saw in your life, how they do that. God's economy is just, there's no bottom line to it. And we just kept watching this stuff come up. And then the first trillion, somebody discovered a bed of trillion down by 9 miles. And everybody went down, you know, with their shorts on and their boots. Really bizarre looking. And of course, no shoelaces tied. And so let's go find, I mean, who needs Frodo and Bilbo? You know, we were all that. And we go marching down there and we see these things, and everybody is like little kids down on their haunches, looking at these trillium coming up through the mud and lifting up your feet, you know. Make sure you don't stop on trillium. And I mean, I could care less about Trillium my whole life long. For 50 years, me and Trillium got along just fine. There's nothing I wouldn't do for a Trillium. There's nothing a Trillium wouldn't do for me. And we went through our lives doing nothing for each other. But now the whole village gets down there and looks at these Trillium. And so I thought, gosh, that's Trinity. And that belongs over the altar. So that's the great mud luscious trillium stuck over the altar. And of course, in the spring, the egg that was cracked and steaming in the winter gives birth. And out of this egg comes the bird. The bird, the firebird, great firebird comes shooting out in the spring. It was like Phoenix, huh? Like the rebirth of the whole thing, starting all over again. And the bird gives birth to all kinds of summer program. Because an awful lot of what happened in the spring was this getting ready stuff, preparing for the people that were coming in. We didn't like the thought. We really didn't like the thought. Because, boy, when the first busload of people came up with those high school kids in there from Portland, Oregon, we all stood out there with our arms folded and just dared to get off the bus. Because they were ruining our village. Oh, yeah, we really resented them coming up and, you know, it's hard to describe how close we were, how close-knit we became during the winter. Just, I mean, inseparable. There are people that we lived with in that winter that are still, they're part of our family. And when they hurt, when something is wrong with them, I mean, some of them are in Connecticut. And when something is wrong, we get a call. We get a call. And they'll fly here in order to talk to us about what's happening. Or we'll fly to Chicago to be with some people that we need to be with, that we just simply became a part of during the winter community. And then these tourists come up, and we gotta make their beds. And Rich has gotta do his dog and pony show every morning at 10:45. And we gotta entertain them, keep them happy. And whole weeks would go by, and we would never even see people that we were so close to because we were so busy doing other things. Werner Jansen, God bless him, took the staff to task. Chewed us out royal for behaving like spoiled rats. And we said, okay. But it didn't work. He had to do it 3 times. We were so bad. We were so selfish and naughty. He says, you just don't even realize that if it isn't for people coming up in the summer, you've got no winter. There is no winter. There is no village. So you don't not only not resent these people, you fight them. You take care of them. You get close to them. And we have to learn how to be village to strangers. And it was tough. It was very hard. A lot of things have happened. Some of you are aware of and are celebrating and learning from Rudy Edmonds. Okay? Rudy Edmonds is a lot of things. Some of you think he's a geologist. He's really not. He's a fisherman, and he does geology to pay the bills. You know? And so Rudy is the village fisherman. And Rudy came in one day and he says, I don't understand this painting at all. He says, you got flowers, you got even an egg. Says, looks like you got a baby in the womb over there. You got snowflakes, you got butterflies, you got Oregon grape, you got birds, and not one fish. And so I said, okay. I happen to be over here at the time that he chewed me out for not having a fish. So I put Rudy Edmonds' great rainbow trout. It is the rainbow trout, the end-all trout. And that has no other meaning except Rudy needed it. That's it. And that's simply the way the village works. That's enough reason for it to be up there. Most of these things are like when people would look up and say, are you sure you want to do that? You know, I mean, but when you're working real close to things and can't see exactly what you've done, you know, from 24 feet away, it looks a little different. And people, I remember one person, when I was working over here, was lying down on the pew here and said, Rich, you better come down here and see what you just painted. And I came down, and had to go up there and do some plastic surgery on the wall. It was a little pornographic, shall we say, or at least graphic, I don't know how porno. Earthy, I think the word is. But it was, there was no question about what it was and what was going on. So we had to adjust a little to that.
See the stuff coming up, the little shoots coming up in the springtime and in the summer. You get the full corn in the ear and all that kind of stuff. All those suggestions came rising up from people on the floor here who would suggest maybe a little of this, maybe a little of that. Like the ant, these little feelers that came off the front of the butterfly,
wound up curling into the winter and curling into the fall and taking on little lives of their own. It took a couple months to do this. At the very end, it was all done. It was all done, and something happened. My son David and a couple of his friends decided to climb Buckskin one morning. Climb the Buckskin Peak, like that one on the left. And they got up there and one guy, who fell from the peak and hurt himself seriously. And David ran down from Buckskin to the village and said, Garth is hurt. The other member of the party was up there trying to keep him warm. He was unconscious, and they were afraid of internal bleeding, all kinds of stuff. David came down in 45 minutes. Unbelievable, this guy, who is all leg, the ends of his leg, they start right here. When we went back up, we saw David's footprints, and we were like, you know, 70 boot things? He was just leaping down this mountain. You know, it was just incredible to watch those footprints. And there was nothing in between this one and that one. You know, so he was flying and very worried about his friend. And rightly so. The whole village marshaled itself, got together, didn't know beans about what it was doing, just knew that we had to get off the ground. We did have a rescue system here. The man in charge of it was Scar. Speak to us! What should we do? He was not out there, so we just had to fumble our way. At any given time of the day, there were like maybe 60 of us over there on this mountain trying to get to him, fumbling around. I had the walkie-talkie, and there was one here, and I was in an advance party going up with stretcher bearers and the nurse. We were in contact with helicopter rescue teams out of Chelan by radio, and otherwise it was really up to us. It was kind of windy on the mountain, and the helicopter was unable to make a rescue up there on the edge, and so we had to bring Garth all the way down to the tailings. And that took from we left here around noon to go up, and we had Garth back on the tailings about 2 in the morning. So we were stumbling around in the dark, carrying this guy, not knowing really how to do what's needed to get done.